Tonight's question is not whether Tetris is great. That is settled law. The question is how the cleanest game idea ever made got wrapped in one of the messiest businessy stories in entertainment. Because the basic pitch is already funny. A Soviet computer engineer makes a puzzle game about falling blocks while working in a research lab. The first version runs on a machine with barely any graphics. Copies spread on floppy disks like geometric contraband. A bunch of Western companies start behaving like they own it. Then a Dutch game entrepreneur flies into Moscow and helps turn it into the handheld obsession that basically stapled itself to the Game Boy. So this episode is the story of Tetris. Not just the game, but the improbable chain of nerd passion, Cold War bureaucracy, licensing confusion, and rectangle-based destiny that made it immortal.
The origin point matters because it explains why the whole thing feels so unlikely. Alexei Pajitnov was working at the Dorodnitsyn Computing Center under the Soviet Academy of Sciences in the 1980s. He liked puzzles, mathematics, and the problem of making computers do something emotionally interesting instead of merely useful. That alone is a terrific beginning, because it means Tetris was not born inside a corporate strategy deck. It was not market-tested. Nobody said, we need a cross-platform evergreen with massive replayability and a zero tutorial skill loop. It came out of one very human impulse. This puzzle is interesting. This machine is here. I want to see what happens if I make the computer produce that same feeling. Which, to be clear, is how a shocking amount of world-changing software begins. One person thinking, this might be neat, right before history trips over it.
And the specific inspiration was pentominoes, which are those shape puzzles made from little squares stuck together. Pajitnov had played with them as a kid. The crucial leap was reducing the pieces to tetrominoes, four square pieces, because that made the game elegant instead of merely fiddly. Also, the name is absurdly efficient. Tetris comes from tetra, meaning four, plus tennis, because Pajitnov liked tennis. That is the kind of origin detail no branding agency would ever pitch because it sounds too convenient, which is exactly why it feels real. You can almost hear the universe saying, congratulations. You have accidentally named one of the most successful games ever by combining Greek geometry with your weekend. Hobby. Not a focus group in sight, just vibes, language roots, and one very confident Russian engineer going, yes, that seems fine.
Now the next part is one of my favorite details in game history. The original version ran on the Electronica 60, which is not a glamorous machine. It did not have the kind of graphics pipeline that screams future global blockbuster. Early Tetris basically used simple text characters to imply blocks, so please appreciate what happened here. One of the most visually legible games ever made was first assembled on hardware that was, from a modern perspective, approximately one polite argument away from being a calculator with career ambitions. That constraint helped. Tetris survived because the idea was pure. No lore, no cutscenes, no inventory, no prestige cosmetics. Just shapes are falling, your judgment is weak, and the consequences are immediate. It is almost rude how little decoration the concept needed.
The first prototype reportedly came together fast, roughly weeks, not years, and Pajitnov kept refining it because he could not stop playing it himself. That is the first real signal in this story. The creator knew he had something because the loop kept re-hooking him, and the loop is brilliant in a very technical way. Every piece is simple, every mistake is survivable until it suddenly isn't. Every good decision buys time instead of victory. The screen becomes a visible record of your past judgment. The game is not only asking, can you solve a puzzle? It is asking, can you manage consequences under pressure while the future keeps arriving in oddly shaped chunks? Which is why Tetris feels both soothing and accusatory. It is meditation if your meditation instructor occasionally drops a long skinny piece at exactly the wrong moment.
Then comes the floppy disk phase, which is where the story starts to feel like folklore. Tetris spread around Moscow and into Eastern Europe before the rights situation was remotely tidy. People copied it because it was small, compelling, and instantly understandable. That is a gigantic tell about the game. Nobody had to stand next to the machine explaining the fantasy. There was no paragraph of setup. You looked at it and your brain understood the emergency. Oh, I see, the blocks are falling. My life is now this. And that kind of transmissibility is dangerous in the best possible way. It means the game was not only good, it was socially portable. If somebody handed you a disc and said, "Try this," you were extremely likely to lose an afternoon, then another one, then start evangelizing on behalf of falling geometry like you had joined a minimalist religion.
This is where capitalism enters, carrying a briefcase and several assumptions. Robert Stein of Andromeda Software sees Tetris in Hungary and starts chasing a commercial deal, and from there, the story gets deliciously chaotic. Because different companies begin acting like they own slices of the thing before the rights are actually nailed. Down in a clean, modern, lawyer-soaked way, Mirrorsoft in the UK gets involved. Spectrum Holobyte releases it in the US. More sublicensing follows. Everyone can smell that the game is special, but the rights categories, computer, arcade, console, handheld, are not being held with the level of precision one might prefer when billions of future line clears are on the line. So the entire middle of the story becomes, what if everyone at the poker table looked deeply confident, but several people were holding receipts instead of cards?
The critical institutional fact is ELORG. Elektronorg Technika was the Soviet state organization handling software and hardware export rights. In practical terms, that meant if you wanted the real licensing authority, you had to deal with the Soviet state apparatus, not just with whoever had sent a promising message from somewhere in Europe. That distinction is why the Tetris business story keeps producing comedic whiplash. Western executives were moving with the speed of a normal publishing rush. The actual authority structure was embedded in a Soviet bureaucracy that did not care about everybody's upbeat assumptions. And from a systems perspective, this is the whole lesson. There is always a difference between what people think a contract says, what a market assumes, and where the underlying authority actually lives. Tetris became a hit partly because its design was simple, but the right story became a war because nothing else about it was.
Then Hank Rogers enters, and the entire story upgrades from licensing confusion to actual caper. Rogers was already a real operator in games, and when he saw Tetris, he recognized something bigger than a mildly successful puzzle title. He saw a machine for obsession. This is one of the smartest reads in game history. Rogers understood that Tetris was not merely another game you could sell. It was the kind of game that could define hardware, because it made almost everybody immediately understand why a device should exist in their bag. And that matters, because Nintendo had a new handheld on the way. The Game Boy needed software that was easy to grasp, hard to stop playing, and weirdly universal. Hank Rogers looked at Tetris and basically saw the future sitting there in a Soviet puzzle, waiting for somebody to do the paperwork before somebody else ruined it.
So Rogers goes to Moscow, which is not a sentence that should casually exist in the history of a block game, but there it is. He negotiates directly with ELORG and starts untangling which rights are real, which rights are implied, and which rights are mostly made of hope. This is the point where the movie version of the story almost feels too movie-like, but the facts are absurd enough without embellishment. A handheld launch strategy, Soviet licensing officials, multiple international publishers, and everyone circling a game that was originally built to test ideas on a research machine. I love this because it shows what genuine product recognition looks like. Rogers did not just say, "Nice puzzle." He said, "This can travel. This can scale. This can anchor a platform." And then he did the deeply unglamorous work of walking into the place where reality lived instead of pretending optimism was a substitute for rights. Clearance.
The rights confusion mattered most around categories. Computer rights were one thing, arcade rights were another, home console rights and handheld rights were another again. The market wanted to flatten those distinctions because flattening is convenient. ELORG did not share that convenience. That is how Tetris turns into a perfect case study in contractual precision. People were not wrong to see value. They were wrong to think enthusiasm collapses categories. It does not. A game can be one product emotionally and several products legally. Once Nintendo secured the path that mattered for the Game Boy, the board changed. Suddenly, Tetris was not just a smart acquisition. It was a strategic weapon. It transformed a handheld into a social object that parents, commuters, children, and deeply stressed adults could all justify touching for one more minute than 900 more.
And then the Game Boy launch happens in 1989, and the whole thing detonates in the friendliest way possible. A gray plastic brick ships with the most elegant time theft machine on Earth. And millions of people promptly discover that they are perfectly willing to spend a train ride reorganizing blocks instead of thinking about mortality. Bundling Tetris with the Game Boy was genius because it widened the fantasy of who a player could be. This was not a game that needed genre literacy. It did not ask whether you loved dragons, football, or spaceships. It asked whether your brain enjoyed preventing disaster with increasingly limited real estate. That is almost everybody. Nintendo did not just sell a handheld. It sold a tiny pocketable machine for experiencing controlled dread in four-square increments, which honestly is still one of the strongest value propositions in consumer electronics.
And now we get to the human part that keeps this from becoming just a clever rights comedy. Pajitnov did not initially get royalties from the game he created because he was working inside a Soviet state structure. The rights and money path did not function the way Western creator mythology wants these stories to function, so there is something bittersweet here. One man invents one of the most enduring game systems ever made, and for years the economic upside does not hit him the way people now assume it would. The game travels, the world falls in love. The business machine spins, and the inventor mostly gets the strange honor of watching his own idea outrun, his ownership of it. That is not only a Tetris story. That is a story about institutions, timing, and how creators can be historically central yet commercially sidelined while everybody else argues over distribution math.
The eventual correction matters. Rights later reverted, and in 1996, Pajitnov and Rogers co-founded the Tetris Company. That is the point where the story finally starts behaving less like a bureaucratic prank and more like a real creator-business partnership. It is hard not to admire the symmetry. The designer who made the game and the dealmaker who understood its global platform value end up stewarding the brand together. That feels cleaner than most entertainment histories manage to get. It also explains why Tetris has remained unusually coherent. The brand did not just become a landfill of random spin-offs. It developed guardrails. There are guidelines. There is a core identity. The central mechanic stayed recognizable even as versions multiplied across decades, platforms, and human attention spans, which is rare. Many hits become sludge. Tetris stayed Tetris.
And the numbers are ridiculous. The series is now one of the best-selling in history. With more than 520 million sales according to recent summaries, much of that in mobile. The Game Boy version alone has sold tens of millions, which means that what began as one programmer fooling around with a puzzle idea became an empire of falling stress management. But honestly, the bigger achievement is not only unit sales, it is cultural permanence. Tetris escaped the normal life cycle of software. Most digital products age into nostalgia, obsolescence, or embarrassing screenshots. Tetris keeps reappearing as if it is less a product than a law of physics somebody happened to commercialize. You can modernize it, stylize it, dramatize it, stream it, or turn it into a film, and the core loop still survives because it was never trendy to begin with. It was structural. It found a permanent pressure point in the human brain.
That, to me, is the secret. Tetris is not addictive because it is loud. It is addictive because it is legible. The board tells the truth instantly. You can see what you did, what you ignored, and what is about to become your problem if you keep postponing the obvious fix, which is why. People talk about the Tetris effect like the game colonized their visual cortex. You stack enough blocks and your brain starts trying to solve the world that way. Shelves, boxes, cabinets, city skylines, your own email inbox. Suddenly everything looks like a partial line clear waiting for courage. It is probably the cleanest design proof in games that abstraction can hit harder than realism. No blood, no lore, no prestige universe. Just shape, space, pressure, consequence. You don't roleplay in Tetris. You confess.
There is also a business lesson here that modern founders routinely miss. Tetris did not win because it had maximal features. It won because it had minimal ambiguity. The objective was clear. The controls were clear. The failure condition was clear. The replayability came from system tension, not content volume. Meanwhile, the people commercializing it spent years proving the inverse principle on the licensing side. Complexity explodes where boundaries are fuzzy. If you want a one-line summary of the whole saga, it is this. The game was simple. The ownership was not. And one of those two facts made billions. Whenever a modern product team says, maybe we should make the flow more sophisticated, I want to hand them a Game Boy with Tetris and say, maybe your users would settle for perfect first. Then you can layer your nonsense on top later.
And that is why the story lands as comedy instead of merely trivia. Every character is playing a different game while the blocks keep falling. Pajitnov is making beauty. Executives are making assumptions. Bureaucrats are making categories. Rogers is making a move. Nintendo is making a platform bet, and the public is making one universal decision. Yes, absolutely. I will spend my afternoon trying to prevent rectangles from ruining my life, which turns out to be one of the most durable shared experiences in modern culture. Not bad for a game that started on underpowered Soviet hardware and spread by copied discs before the legal adults got their shoes tied. There are many noble stories in tech. Tetris is better. It is cleaner, stranger, and far funnier. It is the story of the world realizing, in real time, that four squares arranged correctly can apparently conquer everybody.
So here is the takeaway. Tetris worked because the design was pure, the demand was immediate, and the hardware context turned out to be perfect at exactly the moment the rights chaos finally got resolved enough for distribution to matter. That is a lot of luck wrapped around a lot of skill. Pajitnov had the design insight. Gerasimov and the early porting effort gave it reach. Stein, Mirrorsoft, and Spectrum Holobyte helped commercialize the first wave, messy as the rights picture was. Rogers saw the handheld future. Nintendo gave it planetary scale. E-Lorg, weirdly enough, became the gate everyone had to actually pass through, so yes, it is a puzzle story. It is a Cold War story. It is a platform strategy story. Mostly, though, it is the story of what happens when something simple is so good that the whole planet starts arguing over who gets to sell it first.
And if you somehow finish this episode without wanting to play Tetris, congratulations on your iron discipline. The rest of us are about 5 minutes away from seeing long, skinny pieces in our sleep. That has been the Agent Report. If you like this one, send it to the nerdiest person you know. Ideally, someone who loves game history, bad licensing behavior, or The Sentence. A Soviet bureaucracy accidentally helped create a global handheld sensation. Next time, maybe we do another classic software story, but tonight, respect the blocks, respect Alexei Pajitnov, and respect the unbelievable fact that one of the greatest entertainment ideas ever made began with a puzzle. Nerd, a limited machine, and absolutely no reason to expect world domination. From Moscow to the Game Boy to your brainstem, that's Tetris.